Welcome, listeners, to a special episode of the Greenside Podcast, where we explore the creative minds shaping visionary landscapes. I'm your host, Graciela Martin, and today we're delving deep into the captivating world where creativity meets nature. Our journey takes us across the pond to London, where we meet the innovative Materia Studio. I'm thrilled to introduce to you two incredible visionaries behind the studio. First, there's Christina Morby, a passionate designer specializing in nature-inspired and transformative structures. Her enthusiasm for blending organic and architectural elements is truly inspiring. And joining Christina is Aurora Destro, an architect and artist known for her expertise in merging landscape, art, and architecture. She focuses on the delicate balance of nature, light, and the impact of rituals within spaces. Together, these brilliant minds have collaborated on groundbreaking projects that challenge our perception of art and science. Today, they'll guide us through their creative process, exploring the intricate relationship between human ingenuity and the natural world. So get ready to expand your horizons and challenge your site analysis and conceptual design perceptions. Without further ado, let's dive into this enlightening conversation with Christina Morby and Aurora Destro. Welcome back to the Greenside Podcast. Today, I'm really excited for today's episode. We have Materia Studio based in London, right. And we have two amazing guests, Aurora Destro and Christina Morby. I'm really excited to have you guys, especially since you're across the pond. You're in a totally different country. So I'm really excited to have you, and I'm just going to allow you guys to introduce yourselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Graciela. Yes, we are actually on a different time zone. Thank you for inviting. We are super excited as well. I'm Christina Morby, and I am a designer working at the intersection of landscape architecture and public art, with particular interest into biodesign and the changing structures. So I am really, really excited to be here with you and talk a bit about our project.
Hi, everyone. I'm Aurora Destro. And I'm an architect and artist, and I'm working together with Christina in the intersection of landscape, art, architectures, with particular attention to natural cycles and light and rituals in spaces.
Thank you so much. I think one of the biggest reasons why I reached out to you was because of what you just described, the both of you. And it's just that intersection between art and landscape architecture, which is, I feel, is not as common, or is not as common in, at least in our world or in my circle here. And so I'm really interested in seeing how your story and how you view the world, the lens of which you guys view the world, could really help the landscape architecture field think a little differently about landscape architecture as a whole, and even just not only theoretically but just on the ground. You know, you guys have created just a portfolio of accomplishable, buildable, beautiful projects, which you can actually check out on their website, materia.com. And so, wonderful portfolio you guys have. So my first question to you is, what is the lens that you guys see through when you see a landscape? And the reason why I'm asking is because I'm interested in seeing, going back in time with you both. And we're going to talk about time because I know that that's something important to you, but just even talking about where you guys came from and how Materia came to be. So, you know, what is that lens that you guys view your projects from?
Yes. Well, as you can see from our accent, we are both Italian. I'm based in London, and Aurora, she's now in France. And we share actually our origin. We are both Italian, and actually from a particular part of Italy, which is the Northern Italy. Now, many times when we think about Italy, we think about, you know, the beautiful like sun and the warmth, but actually we are from a very different region. And this, you know, since we were a child, we were exposed to different type of landscape. My region is called Lombardy, and it's a very melancholic region. It's very famous for the fog. And I remember like growing up, I was seeing these like fog blankets covering the landscape and the sunshine just shining on it, and everything looked like floating. So I think this was the first, my first memory of landscape was this wonderful, mystic type of landscape. And then you could see architecture, rural architecture, almost floating in it because, you lose the perception of the horizon with this fog. And I think this one is kind of something that resonates with me and in the past. And for sure, like being Italian, we have been exposed to the wonderful ruins, the patina, the growth of the elements over structures of brambles that you can see in the countryside, taking over farmlands, taking over lampposts. And I think it is something like very special about Northern Italy that really affected the way that we see the project. Aurora, she's from like another region, but always like the north. And she's from like a almost an amphibious region.
Yeah, I'm from the region of Venice, so we share from the countryside actually. So we also share this. So being from the countryside, so having, a flat view on the landscape, so the possibility to see the horizon almost every day. And so my region develops from the Venetian Lagoon through canals. So canals are going into the land. So I grew up actually 10 meters from a canal. So I'm very attached to water, and I have this knowledge of watery landscapes. And also something important which affects the way I see things, I think it's like my parents has this window in the bathroom, which it's almost a 360 degree view on this landscape of vineyards, fog in winter, very nice light. So since I was a child, every morning I looked out from this window in this moment of privacy you have when you close yourself in the bathroom, and I exactly knew in where the sun was positioned every morning. So I kind of had a topography of light in my mind since the very early years of my life. So I'm like, my way of thinking is very influenced by that.
So
And
cool.
I think it's even interesting, like this idea of, as you said before, Aurora and Graciela, this idea of landscape, but how then art came into be. And I think there is something like wonderful about Italy, which is this, architectural ruins and how time kind of appropriated them. And so this is something that it's important for the landscape, but even for the rituals. So because we are from the rural countryside, we have been exposed to the cycle of life, the cycle of rituals, and it's a very particular, almost superstitious region where rituals have been like part of our life. Like I'm from a Catholic religion, like with my parents, and so like all the time, we were going to the church and then discovering the fresco that have been like hidden through time during the plague because people were touching them. So we were always like, I think like what came to be Batteria is this dualism between like nature and this environment that can be water, can be fog, can be, something that use the phenomena and transform the environment and even the rituals, the human rituals that are part of it. So for us it's a sort of like superstitious landscape, but it's like creating this appropriation and this symbiosis and this appropriation of the spaces that we live.
Wow. And it sounds like you had both had a very deep connection to where you're from, and that heavily influenced the design process and how viewing the world that you guys view design through. Growing up in this environment, you must have had such a like a special childhood, just be able to have these memories that you could go back to and say, Aurora, like looking back out the window and seeing exactly where the sun would set. I don't remember paying attention to those things when I was little. I grew up in suburbia, and I grew up where all the homes look the same and where the land is flat. It's just boring, but still a good childhood. But I think that there is something very raw and very ethereal about being in a place where you're in a place as old as time. There's ruins, there's the sun, there's the landscape, there's the fog, there's all of these experiences. And I like the word that you use, Christina, which is ritualistic. You know, can you explain that a little bit more, expound on just the ritual of a landscape and why that's important for landscape architecture and the design of the space?
Yeah, I think like for a long time, at least like in the current practice, we moved away from this idea of rituals, this idea of like appropriation of the space. And as you were saying many times, like places look all the same. They, you know, like we live in a globalized environment. Actually, there's a very good book that I can advise. It's called Designed by Radical Indigenes by Julia Watson. And it's a wonderful book that explores the correlation between human and nature in the past. So when we think about, you know, this rural landscape, there was always something that was celebrating the passing of time. So let's think about, you know, in Italy, for instance, but in all Europe, winter was finishing actually with a bonfire, and there was this like construction that were like built in the central plaza and then like set on fire, and this was celebrating the end of winter. And there was always this kind of correlation between natural cycle, and then there was even a correlation between, as we were saying before, almost religion. So everything became kind of superstitious, like you have to do it in order to greet the new year, you know. And those rituals are still part of our nowadays life, but they've been removed often for the built environment because we have like so many constraints and rules and the way that we perceive that are, we see like unpredictability as something negative, while I think both Aurora and I, growing up, you know, that this idea of unpredictable was actually celebrated through like the rituals that give, you know, like the time frame of the experience, the time frame of the year. And so a place is not, and a space in landscape architecture is not only a three-dimensional space, but it has the fourth dimension. It has the dimension of time, and we can see like spaces growing through time in 10, 20, 50 years, what they could be, and how we can have actually the rituals, which is that cycle. So every year it repeats itself. So it's really about understanding the time as linear in a way, so growth, let's say, time passing. But then there is even a cycle of time. There is a cyclical experience, which circadian time, so the day and night, the year, the seasons. And this for us is so important. We use a lot in our projects the work of phenology. And phenology is something that we adopt from the natural science, and it's related with cycle of nature. So they get recorded, they tell us about climate change, what is happening in the human rituals, but even in the natural rituals of breeding of birds. So like how our work is always trying to bring together, yeah, the nature and the human and how they can live in symbiosis.
The nature and the human, yes. Because we, I think, at times feel so disconnected to our environment that we don't really understand that it really works together. So
Yeah.
that's so inspiring. And so, you know, going back to when you guys were kids, did you know each other when you were little, or did you just, where, how did you both, the both of you meet?
We were matched by a person which was actually my ex-boss in the studio where I was working, and she is a researcher in University Milan. So she was teaching in a design studio with Christina and with me in another design studio. And so she's incredible in matching people, and she was like, guys, you have to meet and work together. And it happened.
Wow.
She was like, you are like sisters that are being like separated, so you need to meet.
Yeah, it's incredible. Even just hearing how you guys grew up and living in both rural towns and your experiences there. And so, what was the studio name, Aurora, where you worked?
Called Sense Lab.
Sense
So
Lab.
it's a studio which develops this research in senses. So basically designing space through with senses. So putting a lot of attention on the olfactory part mainly of space. Yeah, and also on time-based design. The studio doesn't exist anymore, unluckily. So it's just we work together in research and we teach together in Politecnico of Milano.
Wow, very neat. And what about for you, Christina?
How was I matched?
Oh yeah, that and what the studio that you guys were that you were at, I remember you telling me.
Yes, where I was working. I used to work at the Martha Schwarz Partners, which is actually American, but this headquarter was here in London. So Martha is this my first out landscape architect. She's a wonderful individual. I mean, she made the history of landscape architecture, I think. She started, she was telling me like when she was working, when she started like in the 80s, landscape architecture was seen as a discipline that was not considered at the same level of architecture,
Respected,
let's
yeah,
say.
exactly, yeah.
And it was very masculine, actually. Like it was mainly like men driven. And so she was one of the first women that actually decided to, you know, work in this field. Her father was an architect, so she always had this like
Yes.
dichotomy of
Yes.
her father, male architect, and how she made it. And her idea, which affected interest me, was merging, you know, using the language of art, using the language of of art in order to create the sense of places. And so I worked for her and very, very closely. We were working on some wonderful like art features. So there was landscape and what they call like special features. So
Right.
basically within the studio, you could have, you know, like a part that really interested you. So for me, it was like the special feature, the viewing towers, the elements that were like sculptural.
Yeah.
So it was quite an exciting time.
Wow. Yeah, is that interesting to you that we use that special feature word, or do you think it should be called art or
Machine,
yeah.
environmental machine
Yeah.
or device.
A special feature, you
Special feature, yes. I
Wow.
like environmental spatial devices.
Yeah, there you go. That sounds way neater. Very cool. So I think that with your experience, Christina, at a landscape architecture firm, sitting, under a great mentor, I'd imagine, Martha Schwartz. And then Aurora, you had a different experience. You came from a different background, right?
Yeah, actually, I come from architecture, so I didn't study landscape. And yeah, in this is my mainly like my longer experience, I would say, but it was in between architecture, curatorship, exhibition design, and so yeah, somehow it was in between art and space design anyway.
Wow. Yeah, and you're still able to apply those same things to landscape architecture or landscape, in general, right?
Yeah, actually, it's the methodology because I learned how to use this method, which we applied mainly in interior spaces, but I apply it in the landscape. So, in the end, I think that when you know how to use a methodology that works, you can apply it to the scale and to the environment, I would say, which works best for you because each one of us has a scale as a designer, I think. So I wasn't very good at all in interior. I need meters. I don't like centimeters. Like my brain thinks in meters,
Big.
it's big.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and that's true, is that you can apply those same methodologies. You don't necessarily have to call it even landscape architecture. You could, you know, it's the same, you're doing the same thing in a different environment, exhibition, you know, time-based design, art, you know, machines, you know, things like that. It depends on, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be pigeonholed into one kind of discipline. And that's the beauty of doing art in a landscape. And so, can you guys talk to me a little bit more about, you know, this time-based design and sort of how that influences your design process?
Yeah, basically, time-based design is a way to, it's a methodology, what I was talking about. So it's design a space starting from designing the time. So what's happening during time in that space. So I don't see, so you don't see space as just a 3D environment, but it's an emptiness which is filled with time. And so actors are important. Actors could be light, natural cycles, little organisms, animals, or human. So with this approach, you like kind of give importance to time. So the passing of this time, so every detail becomes important. Yes, the act of just sitting on a bench and looking at the landscape, it's something special. So you kind of honor that moment, even if it's just 5 minutes.
Which goes back to this, I think, idea of human rituals and natural phenomena, how they weave together, you know, like spaces. And I think, you know, like when we like the name itself of the studio is like Materia, which I don't know if I mentioned it before, but it means like ethereal matter. And so it's I think the time-based design idea, it's even how we really work with the matter. So, like with the materiality, with the structure, with the bones of what we create, and then the ephemerality of it, which can be plants growing on the structure, birds that are eating part of the structure and create this decay or create an erosion, how human interact with their body with it in different season, in different moment of the day, as Aurora was describing, you know, when you use your body. Actually experience a space, like what does it mean to like enter a space, what does it mean like to look at the sky, and so all these different factors are intertwined and creating, you know, this approach.
Wow. So with all of these different factors, when you're approaching a project, what's your first step? What's the first thing that you do?
Well, it's all our projects are site specific. So we have like a very site specific approach. It means like we want to, I like the word unearthing. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it.
Yeah,
So
yes,
something
yeah.
that is hidden, the heritage, the history. So we need to do almost this archaeological movement of revealing what has been hidden. And this is because, you know, like many times, like spaces and places that we design, we need to use research to discover what used to be there, you know, what has been hidden. And I think this unearthing or revealing, it's part of creating a narrative, but even how to use the phenomena that are specific to that environment and how we can actually use them almost like a puppet master to then create the performance. So when the goal of our studio is we do not design urban spaces or spaces as a series of objects of special features, as we say before, but we design them as a performance. So we start to think, okay, in this place, can we use the sunlight to reveal something that is, like shadows? And so, like, all the structure that we create are actually designed to reveal the shadows using the sunpath. Or can the soil of this land is poor? Can we actually create like structures that decay and nourish the soil, or can be even housing for like maybe there are particular birds living in that area. So can really starting by understanding the environment we live in. And there is always this idea of working through like a research based, but then even like experimental design. So like we try to do to apply architectural archetypes or spatial archetypes that are actually responding to the type of interaction we imagine people to have with the structure, with the spaces. Many times we are surprised about how people use the
Space.
structure, and it's actually wonderful because we really believe in appropriation of the urban environment. So we do not believe that we design like we never. We will never design a bench because you need to sit on the
Sit
bench.
on the
We
bench,
can design an element that you can sit and that you can use your body to sit or to lay, to look at the sky. So we want to have a holistic approach. We don't believe in, straight answers to the design. So we challenge it. We like to challenge.
I love that. And when you're both approaching design, what areas do you both focus on, and what would you say is your expertise? What do you both offer to that make materia,
Yeah, I think like Aurora, she's really the queen of rituals. She's the queen of ephemerality. And I'm more on the matter part. So like I'm really interested into the material decay, how it changes, how creating botanical knowledge to create like elements that grow. So I think like we are Aurora is like the ephemeral queen. I think even Auri, sorry, like I'm talking for you, but you're like a theater.
I
And
like
this
it
came.
very much.
And so when you're approaching this design process, the both of you come at it with your expertise, which complement each other, which work in symbiosis.
Yes.
So, what's hard is that, like, how do you get this built? This is the part that always kind of blows my mind, is that, when you visit a place in the States, for example, it's like, I don't see this ever. Like, how did they get this built? When you're working, on these projects, is there just a lot of red tape that you have to cut through in order to accomplish, for example, like what you had mentioned, Christina, is a structure that decomposes, things like that. How do you sort of approach that?
That's the difficult part, which we see actually every day in our practice. It's convincing the client that a structure that change is something positive, is something that. And this is always, we always have like moments where actually you need to go through like all the specification and how you actually do the checklist, making sure that everything is, let's say, safe or everything, it's been thought through, it's been designed. So one thing that we do in terms of like materiality is a lot of testing. So I don't know if you have ever heard like weathering machines. There are some wonderful machines that test materials and they can accelerate the material aging for like 12 years. And basically you will see like how wind and UV and rain will affect the materials. So this is something that you can do in order to support your thesis. And I think but the main problem that we face is not a lot the materiality and the change. The main problem, which I think is part of the landscape architecture or architecture field, is we are losing the connection with craftsmanship, and which means like all the materials and all the materials, I don't know, the iron come from China, the tiles come from Spain, the fabric come from Italy. You know, like you have all those like globalized projects that, you know, like bring, let's say, material expertise from abroad, because we lost the craftsmanship, we lost the vernacular architecture or landscape architecture. And this is a real challenge. So many times we have like ideas of like, we want to use this material, we want to develop this material, but then it's not possible to do it locally. And we always try to do everything, actually, we always did everything local. So working with small scale fabricators that are mainly focused on maybe art project, and then we just steal them for like more landscape project, and really working with them till the details. We sketch one to one every detail in the workshop, but because like we create this like relationship with them, you know, like they are like extremely skilled, and this is, I think, the field where we found a solution, like using, yeah, working with art fabricator in order to bring the project to life. And that they are, I think, compared to contractors, a bit more flexible in like materials that they never used. So like, you know, you of course, like on one side you have the client that is like, I don't know, you convince them because you're like, look, we tested it, it's fine. And then on the other side is like, when you realize it, when you need to, the realization is, okay, we steal from like the art industry, so that then we can work with those like craftsmanship and the know-how. And they are spectacular. We work with, you know, our fabricator are, you know, wonderful, and they come up with ideas as well, which maybe we didn't think about. So it's, yeah, it's everything we spoke.
I think, yeah, craftsmanship is you make a great point. You know, if you go to many parts of the country or even just parts of the world, you'll find that some places are identifiable based off of their level of craftsmanship. You know, you go to Portugal, you see the beautiful tiles that were created years ago, years, hundreds of years ago. You go to Spain and you see the cathedrals, and you go, you know, there is this level, like you said, and I think is absolutely true, is that level of craftsmanship, the time it takes to pour into good quality designs and good quality and just well thought through, you know, pieces of architecture or design. And so I think that that's an accurate, very accurate, and I haven't heard that argument before, is that what we're missing is a level of craftsmanship. Everything is manufactured. Everything. You know, you buy things from a catalog, you know,
Yeah,
so.
and just to say something positive, I would add that I think that in fact, the majority of people likes this vernacular aspect or the craftsmanship aspect of places, because it gives like a sense of site specificity, which you wouldn't have. So sometimes maybe our is like as designer, and I'm saying like not us, but everyone. Okay, maybe we need to design it the way it's designed everywhere, but usually clients are super enthusiastic when we propose something really site specific. So I'm very positive, like in trusting people taste in general.
Absolutely.
I think that nowadays, like almost everyone is missing this link to the place, the genius loci, you know, the uniqueness of the place of places. So it's very researched around. Like everyone is trying to do something local, traditional, in order to fight the globalism.
Yeah, that's so true. And so, in your process, especially in talking to contractors or things like that, do you guys find the people that, like, do you find, go out and find contractors and find a craftsman, you know, people that do all that, and they all work together well, and you guys were able to find people that were able to communicate well and just sort of accomplish, you know, what you were thinking and planning and
Yeah,
which, yeah.
well, the way that we do is a bit nitty-gritty of the job. We are like the main contractor, so we design and build, which means we have control on, from the moment we start to when we, like we do the opening. And so, which is like a big liability. Like at the beginning when we started, it was scary to be like the main contractor, the final person. It's not only the design, but you're responsible for the construction. But it taught us a lot because we are always, let's say, in control of, every detail of the design. We have to find our contractor, subcontractor in this case, and we work closely to them, and they don't respond to the client, they respond to us,
See you, yeah.
and so there is like a control. It's not a control like negative, but there is like a trust,
Yes.
and a trust between what we want to achieve. And of course we really care that fabricators and contractors, are fantastic, particularly when you give them freedom of, and there is a dialogue. So we don't impose anything. We really talk with them from the beginning. Actually, we do usually, maybe we design something in so 2 3 weeks, very quickly. We come up, with the concept, and just right after, when we win the contract, we start with the fabricator. So we start with the drawings with the fabricator. We start, having meeting with them. We start to see, which material we can use, directly with them on site, seeing it in real life. So I think this way of like working for us has been very good, because it's like, imagine, we are a team with the people that will build it. So we are, we are working as a group, as a team. And then there is the client. So the client will see, what together we came up with. But it's not that the client then tender the project
Right.
and we lose,
Right.
then usually like the results are quite wonderful and the client is super happy. It's just that we take a bit more responsibility.
Yes. Yes,
Yeah.
yeah.
I think that what also play a very important role is this, is that we are very respectful of the work of our fabricator. So because it's like the most important part, basically, like without them we are we can't build. So with this attitude of always showing like collaborators respect, we build a kind of team. So if there is a problem, just to be very a very common thing, no? We design something that is that's too expensive. Classic. Okay, we understand, we don't insist, we know they are working, that they can't do that. So we think about solution, we propose like a new design, something which is good for them. And this way, we build a team, and then everyone is happy, and the project in the end is coherent with the idea of the beginning. And so it doesn't lose the poetic aspect, but we manage to keep it.
What was the most difficult project to put together for you both?
I think it's the one.
And the most exciting too. So both, not too negative.
I think it could be the same. The same one, like fear and excitement feels the same for a human body. So I just came back from actually the site. We went to do a photo shooting this Sunday, and it was the first project on which we were main contractor actually. And so we won this project in Norfolk, very big project. We were super excited. Wonderful design that will interact with the wind, the tides, and it was basically like an observation device, observation feature on the landscape. Really, really exciting project. The problem was It was on a floodplain. So basically, we had this responsibility of we have to build, our idea, our design on a place that the client chose that was flooding twice a day.
Oh gosh. Twice a day.
Twice a day winter, and we were supposed to build in winter. Twice a day it was flooding, so the site was not accessible actually. So I think this is something that we learn is about, yes, we can, design and on a controlled environment in our computer, in our sketches, in the workshop as well, so when we build it in the warehouse, but then you're faced with the wonder of nature. So in that case, we had to research and understand how that environment was behaving. So we had to build around the tides. So there were like two tides per day, two high tides, which will flood the landscape on which it was sitting it. But we had to study the tidal calendar to understand, okay, when can we access? And so it was all like a problem solving since the beginning. Then once we solved the problem of the tides, so like type of foundation that we can use, which tall we have, how we can actually dig if the water is coming out. So it was like a lot of problem related to the site. And then there was the ecology part, which we really like, but there was a problem of like time frame. So there was this like bird that was nesting in the area. So we had to wait. We could have, at the end we didn't because the bird was fine. He left. But we had to build like around all this environment really in an organic way. So we have, we knew like if the bird would have been there, we could not access the site because it would disturb it. So I think in particularly in UK, there is this wonderful like attention about nature and the environment. And so everything was difficult in a way that it was a lot of bureaucracy. Like basically all those information were coming from the council, from like environmental agency, from all those like different roads authorities, so all different like authority that were one was managing the water, the other one was managing the environment, the other one was managing the flood, the other one the ecology of the site. And we had to respond to all of those questions that they had. And so we learned so much. Like we learned how to actually, once you break the problem into smaller problems, it's much easier. And little by little, we solved all the puzzle. We installed it like, We installed it in, I think, 2 days. It was
Wow.
nothing went wrong because there was all this work behind of really knowing the site. I know the site by, and like I know everything about that site. I
Yeah,
know
wow.
where is the water. I know like what is underneath it, like even 20 meters deep. You need to like really commit it. But the result, I was there yesterday. It's incredible, particularly when it floats. Like you have this like structure that is on the water, and if you go on it, it looks like you're walking on water, and there is this reflection. And so like something that actually was a problem, that was the floats, the tides, actually became like what makes this project so special, because you have this reflection and it's like it's floating on the infinite. It's fantastic. So I'm super excited about this project.
Wow. That sounds like an amazing experience. Wow. And that you both even that you were saying that the if you break it down into smaller problems, understanding the site that kind of forced, you to understand the site, understand how it works without even realizing it made it so much better in the long run. What's the name of the or can we know the name of the project?
Iron Reef. It's the Norfolk Way Art Trail.
Okay.
Is in Reedham in Norfolk.
I'm going to keep an eye out on it because that sounds really neat. And that actually brings me to my next point is the amount of work that you both have on, I was looking on your website and it was just since 2013. And you've been able to keep a consistent language within your designs. And my favorites I looked at, I've seen, is the Spring Gateway in China.
Yes,
That
that was
one, so neat. I mean, I think that when I saw the pictures of that one, I was like, that looks like it will last forever, and it will be in history, forever. It's a big, it's a structure,
Yes. Actually, that project, it was with Martha Schwartz. So, like, it was they gave me this project, which was actually a background story. Like, a client was allegedly a bit more difficult, and so like they asked me, Christina, do some, come up with something for this client. And so what happened is, I think like in a night, I designed like three options. And then the client was super happy, and they decided to build that one, the spring option.
Yes.
And but then there was even another option, and they decided to build or to build like six of this other option. And then they came back like they wanted us to do like a culture park. So, from something that no one wanted to deal with this client. But then like it changed.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a really, really good project. Yes. Yeah.
Very,
With
yes.
Atelier One was the structural engineer. I had, yeah, it was a wonderful time. Yeah.
Wow, very
Yeah, Christina is a design magician.
I
Yeah.
was gonna
It's
ask
really
you about,
incredible.
yeah, it was incredible.
So happy we work together. Yes.
Yeah, I would imagine you guys both make such a fantastic team. And I was gonna ask you, Aurora, like, what projects were your favorite, working, I guess you guys have been around Materia Studio for how long now?
2018, that's when
2018.
2018, and
Wow.
Aurora joined 2020, just for
2020.
lockdown. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So what has been one of your favorite projects to work on at Materia, and even just before Materia, what were your favorite kinds of projects?
I think the sundial, that's something we did together this summer, because I really like the high experimental degree of the project. It was for a festival, so a temporary structure in the Austrian Alps. And the clients, well, the curator, they were really open. And so I have never known something like a relationship with the client like this. Basically, we were selected and then we had total freedom.
Wow.
So yeah, I really
Wow.
enjoyed it. So we found a person, a local constructor, which was really incredible. And so yeah, it was interesting. And somehow I think it's the first time I applying the reality, this logic of sun position cycles, because the project itself is a sundial, so it traces the sun movements with shadows in this. So yeah, it was a super interesting to see working in the real world.
Yeah, and it makes it better when you work with people that are easy to work with, And so looking back at the process for you both, and not just the design process, but I mean, becoming from where you were to who you are today, what were the challenges that you faced in that?
Well, I would say having a practice that is working
Yeah.
and that should work, but in between different fields, different disciplines, like it's not like completely art, it's not architecture, it's not landscape design. So it's a bit energy consuming to always move in among those blurred borders. Because you don't know your next step. Like there is not a path that you can follow. It's like when you start working in an architecture studio, then you are a designer, then senior designer, then
Yes, a ladder, right?
you know what's happening next. And so and I don't. it's like building this every day in a coherent way. I think it's the most difficult challenge for me.
And what about you, Christina?
I think since I was at university, I knew I wanted to open my practice. So like I think like since then I had the luck of having a professor that really believed in me on a way. And so that was like quite important. So they knew what I was doing. They knew how, you know, to how to help me. And so since I started working in practice, I knew that I wanted to have my own suite. And so I kind of started to work in that direction. But the main problem, let's say, that I faced is when you have to do the jump. So like at one point, you know, like you need to decide that you are ready, like that you will, we were saying before, like, and something that I really believe, fear and excitement feel the same.
The same.
And so sometimes I trick my mind into, I remember like my first project I got with Materia. It was a hotel in Clerkenwell. And it was really like I was very junior, very, very young. And I had to, you know, there was this contract developers and I had to like sign this contract. And I remember I was tricking myself. I was like, Christina, fear feels like excitement. So if you tell yourself, I'm excited, actually, I'm not scared, I'm excited, then it's easier to
Wow.
do the jump, you know, like, you know, it really feels the same. And so it's even like tricking our mind because we never feel we are ready. You know, there is our mind is always a 90% mode for anything that we do. We are never like 100% ready. So it's about, you know, like trying, you know, at one point, you know, you decide that the jump and being ready is actually working and the process of working towards something. The important is to have like a vision. What do you want to do? How you want to spend your days? And I think, I don't know, we are so lucky like to have like the most beautiful work in the world, you know. We draw, we like sketch, we, you know, it's we are blessed as creative, you know, like to work in this environment and continuously learning. I think that actually going back to the question, what was the most difficult part of my career was the moment that I knew I wasn't learning. I wasn't learning anything new. And I think that point is when I decided to make the jump to open the studio. It's when I stopped learning on a way because I was in the same project or like doing the same things, and it can feel alienating.
Wow. Fear and excitement are the same feeling. That's so key, is that when we're afraid of things that we don't know yet or we haven't experienced yet, there is an excitement, but it is terrifying. But you'd rather be there than being stuck and complacent. And you wouldn't have Materia, studio. You guys wouldn't be doing what you're doing today if you weren't first afraid and excited, so that's really, really inspiring. And I think that'll inspire, even people who want to start their own business, because that's everyone, I think, that is encountering something that they've had a vision for in their mind. And so I would say that even for me, like that's totally applicable for me personally, because being afraid of the future, I think at times is my favorite question. My friends always say is like, your favorite question is what if, what if this and what if that, and and it's just, you don't know. You just have to take the leap and go forward and take the next step. So yeah, and it's really inspiring to see where you guys have come, how far you've come, and just taking that next step. I mean, the both of you are just geniuses anyway, so it was bound to happen. But it's really inspiring either way. And so I guess my next question to you is, I like to ask this question to some people because I think it is important to hear what's going on, like, in your mind when you think about it. But a lot of people hate this question, so Don't feel pressured to answer it. It's not scary. It's, you know,
I'm
what is
excited.
I'm excited. What is it's not that crazy. But what is your definition of landscape architecture? And I'll give you why, you know, people don't like it. It's one of those things that people are like, it's too broad. I can't pigeonhole it. But I think that it's broad enough to allow people to have their own definitions.
It's a conceptual, I think the landscape architecture is a conceptual space of human geography. So it's landscape is not landscapers per se, landscape architecture is not landscapers per se, but it's through the eyes and the experience of human and more than human. So like when we break down, you know, like our perception of the environment, and how we work and what we see and how, you know, like we create spaces. And then I think then you have landscape architecture, which is not to me infrastructure. Like in the moment we lose the human scale, which is the way that we experience the world, then to me it's not landscape architecture. There is this idea of the creation of spaces. So how do we work? What do we perceive? How, and then of course like other species as well, but we design with the idea of this experience, you know, how do I work here? So there is experience, there is time, and I think it's a choreography to me, landscape architecture.
And I would add that I totally agree, of course. And yeah, I would also add that it's like, so landscape architecture, it's a system that works in with ecological relationships in between all the organisms, also with architecture itself. So at every scale, life is happening inside. So little organisms in material, human scale, but also let's say astral, the astral one, the biggest.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, that was a perfect answer. Answers.
Yes. Well, we are good improvising stuff.
Yeah.
This was not in the question.
No, I love it, and I've really enjoyed talking with you both, and I really am excited about this interview because it's going to come from I think a different perspective and a perspective that needs to be discussed more, and I've felt just an excitement, you know, talking with all of your projects and all the things that you guys are doing. I just have an excitement to talk about what you do because it's not just about the work and having it, you know, printed on a plan so that it can be built. It's more than that. I think a lot more than that is being, you know, considered in your designs. So thank you so much for being on the podcast. And yeah, I'm really excited for everyone to hear it.
Thank you so much, Graciela. You were wonderful. We had a wonderful time with you, and we hope to hear from you soon again. Keep us
Yes.
posted.
I will.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening journey through the intersection of creativity, nature, and landscape architecture. We hope you found inspiration in the words of our incredible guests, Christina Morby and Aurora Destro. It was an inspiring conversation for me, and I really hope that you enjoyed it since I've never interviewed anyone from the London, UK. If you enjoyed this episode and want to stay updated on our future explorations of the artistic landscape architecture world, make sure to subscribe to our channel on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Your support fuels our passion for bringing you thought-provoking content. Stay tuned for our next episode next Friday, where I interview an inspiring woman who has been making waves in the landscape designer world and is inspiring thousands of people with her designs on Instagram and many with her very own Domestika course. Also, if you'd like to contribute to the growth of the Greenside podcast, consider supporting us on Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the description. Your generosity helps us continue to bring you in-depth interviews and inspiring stories from the creative world of landscape architecture. Don't forget to follow us on social media for behind-the-scenes glimpses, updates on upcoming episodes, and more. You can find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook at the Greenside Podcast. Thank you once again for being part of our amazing community. Together, we're exploring the limitless possibilities of creativity in the landscape architecture world. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep creating, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible. See you later.